I just think it's important to say, without being a complete weirdo, that you know, man, you're a real hero to me. You know, I think for any of us that kind of do what we do, and coming up, when I came up, you know, it's not just like the performances you've laid down and just uncompromising commitment to your choices and the kind of artist you are, but also the life you've lived. I just have just complete and utter reverence for you, man. And I hope that doesn't color this too much. But I just want to start out with just real gratitude.
Well,
that you're doing.
I have it for you. I think, you know, you are once a sensational actor. And when I told you, when I first saw that conversation you did with Shia, I just thought, well, that wasn't going to be, I won't say brought out of him, with someone else, because he is such an incredible runner of them, just very spontaneously. But there was something about the patience and the care that you gave your subject in it that made it really great.
In the film, in the documentary Superpower, you started with a quote. And I was wondering if we could just talk about that quote a little bit. I got it written down here. I can read it if you want me to read it.
Sure.
Yeah. In the time of your life, live. So in that good time, there shall be no ugliness or death for yourself or any life your life touches. Seek goodness everywhere. And when it is found, bring it out of its hiding place and let it be free and unashamed. In the time of your life, live. So that in that wondrous time, you shall not add to the misery and sorrow of the world, but smile to the infinite delight and mystery of it. So you said that you carried that quote around with you for a long time in your wallet, and it had a particular resonance while you were in the Ukraine. I'm just wondering, when did that start? How'd you find that quote? When was the first time it had significant meaning for you? What has it meant for you, and why did it have such resonance while you were there?
There's a woman named Martine Getty. She introduced me to a guy named Roy. Now Roy had the place on Sunset Boulevard where all the fancy people would go, and I think that they would go to extreme lengths to have a very good time at Roy's. Yeah. And that was the 70s, you know. And that line is stolen from Warren Beatty, said that about Jack Nicholson, a man who'd go to extreme lengths to get into a good mood. but it was that kind of, it was that place.
Yeah.
And so Roy was, I guess, a very colorful, very liked host. And he had it in his head that he might want to direct a play. And he got Penelope Milford, who had just, you know, been nominated for an Academy Award for Coming Home. He got Bobby Newirth, who was with Big Brother and the Holding Company. He got Carlos Palomino, who'd, you know, just rocked the ring for many years. He got Marissa Berenson. He got this cast for William Saroyan's The Time of Your Life. And they needed the newsboy. And the newsboy would not have been of age to go into Roy's and play like the big boys played and the girls played. So they were auditioning at the Actors Studio West out here. And I got an audition through this woman I knew in class who knew Roy. And yeah, I felt like I think he was so relieved to have a young person show up for the thing. And I guess they didn't cast a wide net or put it in drama log or any of those traditional ways we'd find out about the audition, sit in church for 6 hours to read a few lines and get rejected. But here it was more like you walked in the door and he was busy, and, you know, maybe he was busy, you know, he had a lot of energy that day, and he just pretty much cast me. So here we are. I go to Sam French before going down there, and I pick up the play. And Saroyan had written a kind of preface to the play that I think you'd only find in the actual playbook. whether or not anybody had ever used it, maybe having a solo performer come out and speak those words to set up a tone or at the end or something one could imagine. I don't know, but the play was remarkable. I found out that it had been the most performed play in the American theater. Universities had done it everywhere. It had toured everywhere. And really, just kind of writing and a look at the world that was new to me. But that piece just really, really struck me. And then I went into the third rehearsal. And in the play, I sing When Irish Eyes Are Smiling. I had not warned Roy before the first two rehearsals that when I sing, it damages people. And I say that like with a serious face because I know it's going to sound like a joke, but it damages people. It's fucked up. Yeah. I've had this, singing teachers say, no, anybody can sing. You've just got it. And then, you'll never see those people again as they stop. So I hear Roy from the classic lights are in your eyes on the stage. He's in the dark, the actor's studio. He says, hey, Sean, just today, just talk the song through. Needless to say, I got fired and took the job as the understudy. Never got to go on, which was good for me. But I came away with this incredible, this thing.
Yeah. You carried it around with you. What can you kind of talk about what it meant to you, what it means, what the quote means, how it's guided you?
Yeah, I think it was potent to me when these words that so encouraged the best of us, the least judgmental of us, the most compassion, the most gratitude for this big miracle of life that we've been given by something, right? And with each other. And in that, if the time comes in the time of your life to kill and have no regret. In that context, did I see that this was, what the weapons that these people were wanting to supply were not the weapons of hatred. They were not the weapons of fear. They were the weapons to necessitate the freedom and the security of those that were attacked. And so I think that I had felt that thing many of us feel, certainly my generation, and I think I would guess with a person like you, that we come up against whatever that is where we've got to be tough about something. Mm-hmm. And not necessarily have it associated with the ugly, fearful violence that comes of male ego, but this noble will to kill, to do something that is not in our nature, that is going to damage us, but for a greater good. And so the Ukrainians have all that spirit. And it's so tangible of they will not be denied their humanity, their freedom, and they're really all in it together. And if they have to kill as they are having to do now, that's a kindness to the future generations. It's a gift. And Soroyan was able to not get caught up in the way that we soften a culture. I think that there's so too much tolerance where the privilege to soften exists. People fall for it. And, it's talked a lot about in terms of masculinity being under siege. Well, I don't see it as under siege, and I don't think it's just a question of masculinity, because God knows the thing I'm talking about equally involves women over there. Toughness. And it's a beautiful thing. It's a tragic circumstance that lets a dumb kid from LA like me be able to see it that clearly. you need to make it really loud and clear, but boy, are they. So that's, you know, if I could say it better than that, I'd be Saroyan writing it, right?
Yeah.
But that's essentially what it is.
You know, I often think about, you know, growing up, you know, there's such fear-based and shame-based violence that I think young men perpetrate because they're scared shitless and because they're ashamed of something or they're not getting love from somewhere. And I remember growing up, it was when I would talk about, you know, at the time of my life where you know, my friends and I were you know, getting into a lot of street fights, and there was a lot of that kind of stuff, and not on a scale that so many people in this country sort of have to deal with day in and day out. But I remember it was always what it was kind of whittled down to for me. It was a way of showing your friends that you were there for them, that you had your back, and that there's that kernel of standing up in love. And I guess when you take it to the extreme of what these folks are going through over there. You know, where all of a sudden, I mean, how would you define it? Is it honor? I guess you use the word standing up. I mean, what did you recognize over there in those folks from that quote, the fearlessness to take up arms and the necessity to do it? How would you define that?
I think that, you know, feeling powerful. And by powerful, I'm not now talking about an adolescent view of that, nor a authoritarian view of it. But you look at what we're part of, you know, going back to how Saroyan celebrated the lighting and the wonder and the mystery of this big place, right? As part of that, we're part of that power, right? And in community, we become stronger, healthier.
Yeah.
A democracy becomes stronger and healthier, and they work for each other. What's there is getting that human necessity fulfilled. And you feel it because you feel it. I feel it because I'm not getting that necessity fulfilled in the United States of America right now. I don't feel the power of us. Of us in this place, in Ukraine. You get off the plane and it is a different kind of air you're breathing. And with all the horror and all the suffering and damage and sacrifice and death, there's also this power of unity. And you feel it, you really feel it. Yeah. And it's that was the catalyst of these years of the seed of Saroyan, you know, in well, not what I am, but what I hunger to be and to see in a community. Except perhaps for some sociopaths, anywhere in the world, you know, it's that power people are seeking. And sometimes we think of it as a luxury. But it really is a need that sometimes is not fulfilled by one generation. And so there's a sadness in the losses of those generations that never got to have it. And what's not all wrong about fighting when you're a young man, you know, you did it with whatever the fears are, or the ego things that we go through.
Yeah.
You know, when you're talking about making loving, feeling community, feeling power in that moment, even if unformed, it's an essential thing and maybe a better alternative than not feeling it at all as a young man or woman, which I feel is very common today.
Yeah, me too.
You know, and I would never say, hey, everybody should go scrap again, you know, but there was some value in some of those mistakes we made.
Absolutely.
Which were the collateral stuff of that bonding.
And the bonding and the, I mean, look, I think the film captures the tenor and the atmosphere of of an impending attack. And I mean, the only thing that I can really compare it to is Restrepo, is another documentary that I love so much. And that going through the reality of that with Marines and with the military, this does it on a civilian level and on a political level for what these, how these people bonded, how they, and a lot of that came down to sort of the timing of the entire project. Can you just kind of walk us through what this thing set out to be and then what it turned into?
Yeah. By the way, these are fantastic. This is, and if you, the smoke bothers you too much, you can just do that and it blows it away.
It's for the camera? This is for a camera, right?
You know, I use it for even, you know, just to clean up.
Just to clean up shit?
I'm a little OCD on that. That's why I got those mini vacs over there. So it was in this room. I had a friend, Billy Smith, who produced this with me. And Billy's an actor. You know him.
Yeah.
And I had not ever met him. I didn't know who he was. We met at the CGI.
He was a cop, right? Wasn't he a cop?
He was a cop.
Yeah, met him like way back in the day. He was so fucking good to me, man. One of my first gigs, dude.
He's a fantastic guy.
Yeah.
He was a Boston PD cop. Yeah. He was a UN police officer who posted in a few different countries, and an actor throughout, and a Marine. He was, you know, stationed out of Kuwait in the first Gulf War, but always an actor. Even when he was, you know, a cop, he would get ragged by his fellow cops for going off and doing that pansy thing he was doing or whatever.
I know that well.
Theater groups and such.
Yeah.
And we met at the CGI in New York when he had made an interesting documentary about Pakistan. And I was starting to think about making documentaries a little bit. And we talked, we became friends. And so then we set off to make a couple that didn't happen. I went down to Syria a couple of times during the war and met Assad and had the idea that we would do this documentary about how is he still standing 5 years after the Arab Spring. And then we'll go talk to the Russians and the United States and the Jordanians, the Lebanese. We'll try to get, how did this guy manage after everybody said he was counted out, right? And I am not saying this in a celebratory way. But I was going to approach it very, we'll see what comes. And at first Assad was extremely open and, he, you know, certainly knew how to talk to, a Westerner who's coming over to make a documentary and say things that would, sound very rational and so on. And bit by bit, it closed down. We did say you could talk to some ISIS prisoners, but now you can't do. We did say you could talk to the former opposition press because with the war there were no opposition press. We did say that you could, you know, not have a minder and go talk to whoever you want on the street. But now let's say you can't do those things. Let's see what else you can do. And we walked away from it. I didn't feel that I was the guy to do that documentary, that investigative journalist one where you're told no by everything and you keep going. I wanted to see if I could do, you know, the trust one.
And
I just felt that's where I would have something of value added. And when I saw, I couldn't really get it. And I don't know if it was him or his gatekeepers, but it got shut down. So then we had tried on another one about Khashoggi. And while we were in Istanbul, we found out there was another filmmaker already doing it, very well financed, very good filmmaker. And our interest was that a film on Khashoggi get done. And we thought that, you know, that guy's got it. So we left that one. We're kind of looking for, and obviously we were attracted to where maybe my access could get us in on one of the more urgent stories in the world. Now we here in America hear about, a bad phone call between our president, Donald Trump, and the president of Ukraine.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have more regional experience, have lived in Russia and so on. But I knew very little about Ukraine. And but I had been intrigued about this comedic actor who, played a teacher who gets suddenly a write-in candidate, becomes the president, and he's got a successful show. It's the comedic West Wing. He's Martin Sheen.
Yeah.
And then he runs for the real presidency and wins. It would be Martin Sheen as president.
It's fucking wild.
Yeah. Wouldn't necessarily be a bad thing either. Yeah. So, Martin Sheen, I understand. Generically actors.
I know.
But, so this is long before the Russian buildup. This is pre-COVID. And Billy came to me with the idea because he had contacted Zelensky. He met somebody, knew him. And I said, that might be fun, getting ourselves and all this heavy stuff and, running into doors. And this lighthearted, whimsical tale of this actor. So we started pursuing it, and then COVID happened, and we were delayed. And over COVID, I got to meet President Zelensky over Zoom. Very engaging guy. And sort of told him what I'd like to do. And it comes down to this: what kind of documentary can I offer that's going to be, have a place with all the great documentarians out there and doing things? Why get in the way? And it was going to be if I could create, some kind of a special candor or trust and have an unguardedness of personal, not in a Barbara Walters sort of personal, but, a vibe.
Sure.
And I also noted that, he spoke better English than he thought he did. And I thought it would be great to share this guy with America, and that it might be good to try to get him to speak English in this thing. Conversations would flow better also, because I wouldn't be going through a translator. So by the time we actually got to see him, because it was not, I don't think that I was motivated enough to go and spend 14 days in a hotel room to maybe see him.
Right.
And we just put it off till the COVID thing ended. And by the time we got there, by the time we could sort of get everything back going, it was November 2021. And yes, the buildup was in the news. It was simmering. There were about, 85,000 troops, Russian troops at the border, some equipment moving. But as we know, within, a month of that, it was nearly 200,000 troops and, the whole nine yards. And so we went to see him in November, and that did not work out because there was a very, very intricate operation to capture, just in a sting operation, to capture by name, by face, the guys, the Wagner Group guys, who had brought down that airliner a couple of years earlier.
Yeah.
And when we got there in November, just as they were going to nab them, and it's all open source to read about what they did. It's really interesting, led by Ukrainian intelligence, but I think with help from our guys in the UK. There was a leak, and they all scattered. And there was some suspicion that it was someone in the president's office. So they were under crisis management and couldn't see us. So we went, picked up the culture a little bit. We went out to Mariupol, the front lines of the existing problems since 2014. And, took it all in. Met with a lot of different kinds of people. By the time we were able to come back and to be told that if you can come and stay a week, the president will find a time to see you. That's great. Let's go. That was February 2022. Yeah. So we're there, and we're being patient with it. We're confident he's going to see us. But by the time I was leaving, there was already the maximum travel advisory in place. It was hot. In fact, they were saying it's going to happen tomorrow for about a week and a half. And tomorrow would come and tomorrow would go. You didn't see it happening. I started out not believing it was going to happen. I was still in February, early February. I was absolutely, I understood that all intel, you know, that whether you're, wherever you were hearing it, were believing it was happening. But there were a couple of key people who knew the region really well, who, like me, felt there's no upside in this for Putin. You know, you're just going to, you break it, you buy it, you're going to have, I'd gotten to know Ukraine well enough. They were going to fight. They would all be willing to die before they'd let this happen. And that would be true if the Russian invasion had succeeded in February.
And did you have a sense of that on the ground? I mean, could you feel that already?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, like nothing I'd ever, part of what we were talking about earlier, this unity thing was, they all had a red cape on them, in my view. They just ready to go. And within that, which is a really important thing, I have a blanket around here somewhere from the railroad. The Ukrainian railroad motto is iron and soft. And it's exactly the, to me, the Soroyan piece. To be iron, you have to maintain your humanity. And you've got to laugh and sing. And, you know, there's so many touching stories of how gentle warriors, but man, warriors is in block letters. The symbolic victory that would have been the most, and what we all likely thought would have happened, victory of the Russians, would only have been symbolic. They would have bought generations of insurgencies.
Yeah.
There would never have been, why the hell? What good is this for Russia?
Yeah.
So, we're getting the calls, and you on your cell phone now, you're not getting texts that have black letters. Now you're getting red letters from the State Department saying, you know, Americans should not, and so on. But it didn't, so by that time we felt like it was going to happen, because now we're late in that week. Putin had given the speech, the red line speech.
Yeah.
And it was an extreme speech. And I didn't sense that that he could back off of that. And so, fuck, this thing's actually going to happen.
Yeah.
And then your heart gets into it, because their hearts, that ownership of the need to dream for freedom, is everything that we've grown up with. It just, it suddenly triggers you into something that's primal. And it becomes, I now love these people that, so I meet Zelensky on the 23rd. And I always said to him, I don't want, the first time we meet face to face, I don't want to have a camera there, because I thought that if we were going to have that kind of a thing, we can't have it from go on camera.
Yeah.
Similar to wanting to, you know, meet you before we did this, you know, it's just better in the room with a person. And we had a really good meeting and agreed that we would start shooting the next day. And yes, reasonable people at that time, and I had become one, felt that any day now this thing's going to happen. And you want to celebrate the soft also, and live here and be with, you know, and see that guy who is being human in the face of this thing. And then we went back to the hotel, and that lighthearted tale of a comedic actor turned president got rewritten on us in fairly dramatic fashion. And so I don't remember if I actually got to sleep, but I remember my eyes were closed when those first rockets came in, and it was, okay, the world just changed. And I keep talking about this film, and I can only say it was so heartbreaking that you didn't experience any fear, you know, even as someone not involved on that level. And I felt like this is world changing. This is going to test my kids, and those kids I saw earlier today in Kyiv, that man that I met this afternoon, met me previous afternoon, he's a wartime president against a nuclear power.
Yeah.
It was too big to process.
Yeah.
So we were up all night, of course, trying to figure out get a real situational clarity. And and we got a call in the morning from the president's office saying, let's do this. You know, war just started, you know? And I just thought he might be too busy, but he was so, and has shown how smart and clear-minded he knows this world, and he knows that if you're going to have victory, you've got to communicate. And this is an opportunity. The gamble is on whether I or my partners will do it well, but we're the ones that are there.
They're there.
And it's an opportunity on this day to share with the American people an essential ally, right? And so I think that I was, within the context of the circumstances, just so extremely lucky to have had the opportunity to be there at that time. And then it became this documentary superpower.
Yeah. You've got Republicans in office who are already tirading against support for Ukraine, and now everybody's focused on what's going on in the Middle East. So where do you think this is going? What do you want? How do you look at it?
Well, here's how I look at it. It circles back to this idea of power. Who do we want it to have been? And what do we want the result of who we were to be for our children, for generations to come? We are disavowing any claim of loving our children if we allow these things to go forward. We're just fucking them, saying, fuck you, I don't care, because I want to be a big shot now. And being a big shot now is, I'm going to say, we're America only. We know we were never America only, right? That doesn't work. It doesn't work. And it's true on the left also. All of those people who are, you know, I'm not sure, maybe I'm with Robert Kennedy Jr. who says we shouldn't go into there. Well, God damn you. I'll tell you, I know exactly where you're going to be. You're going to be the bitch who's standing out there with a sign on behalf of the starving in North Africa in 2 years from now, saying, we've got to help these people. How do you think they got in trouble? Yeah. You got 3 feet of black soil in Ukraine that feeds that half of that continent. And now you can't get to that, and it can't get to you. And you're complaining because you said we're hawks. So it's time to buck up and say, what's really going on here? No question, Putin will not stop if he's allowed to go on. Why would he? And the question is asked very clearly by people who know more than I do in a film. And then when we get caught up in, you know, what the media thing is. So you had just had this horror show, ongoing horror show in Israel. Mm-hmm. Get involved, because these people are involved on your behalf.
That's right.
And there's the other part of it, the pushing leaderships to acknowledge the parts of their history, or in some cases, current policies that encourage some of the bad action. So you've got to, when the time comes and the time of your life to kill, these militants have to be fucking killed. This ugly horror show, that doesn't mean there aren't some very serious things to be looked at within those who are being attacked's leadership. Same in the United States. We can think two things, right? I remember a fantasy I had of George Bush after 9/11. And I thought, you know, just get up there. Mm-hmm. Look in the camera and tell America what you're going to do. Because you haven't asked anybody's permission. And you've told the White House counsel, stay out of your life for a week. And you're ready to go to jail if you're violating some law. But unilaterally, you've got special operators in Tora Bora right now. And we're going to kill them. We're going to kill every one of them. And I'll go to jail for it if I have to, because that's my job. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But now we also got to start looking at how we affect extreme poverty around the world, mm-hmm. and create the fertile ground for this kind of evil. You know, I think we just got to make trendy a little bit of nuanced thought, a little bit of the ability to look at both sides of a thing without being accused of somehow being an apologist for, you know, one absence of good for another.
But at the same time, calling evil, evil. There has to be a line that you don't get forgiven. There's nothing more powerful in this world than forgiveness, man. And
yeah, I say call it evil when it's productive to do that. It's uh-huh. the same thing I think about when I, you know, I hear these people whose constituencies are solid for them. And it's very hip that they call themselves a socialist. Hmm. Well, you know, I always think about that if your granny can call 911 when she hears somebody breaking into her house and the police come, that's kind of a good thing, right?
Yeah.
And that's something we can all, the great granny was saved because she could call 911. Then the question I have for people who get up, you know, all scared of socialism then is which credit card did she use to pay them when they left?
Yeah.
So there were times that, you know, it's such an indulgence to use words that we know are inflammatory,
yeah.
right? Let's take Israel, for example.
Yeah.
I don't think I'd be satisfied if nobody was calling it evil. But I'm very grateful that there are some who are just being more sober than to use any kind of word that somehow to other people may show that you're not getting it.
I mean, one of the things that I'm sort of left paralyzed with now is who the fuck is going to lead us out of this? Who are they? Who is the person?
Well,
I do think that we're
not all leaders on that level, and we're not all leaders in even in small parts of our lives. Some of us are, most of us hope to be, and all of us are responsible to be, but not everybody succeeds at this for various reasons. But I do think the leaders are going to be dominantly, before noticing, let's say, that Putin is evil, which like, that's my level. I don't know that someone like Zelensky needs to take it that far. What Zelensky feels, and I saw it in him, and it was so refreshing, and I think it speaks to his leadership, his inherent gift and courage and clear-mindedness as a leader, calm. He says, you know, it's not very interesting.
Yeah.
That's what great. He says about Putin.
That's great.
And you sit there and you say, I want to hear what else you got to say, because
yeah.
That's true. So true. I just realized that's true. It sort of reminds me, Bukowski had a poem about I saw a genius. I met a genius, and you know, he's riding the rail from Los Angeles to San Diego. And you know, this ocean, it's what it is, this section of ocean, depends on the sky that day or this, but, and we tell ourselves, oh, it's beautiful. Oh, it's beautiful. The ocean's beautiful. And he's riding the rail with a seven-year-old kid, and the kid looks at him at a certain point. They're both looking out the window of the train. The kid looks at him and says, it's not beautiful. To which Bukowski responds in the poem, it was the first time I realized that.
So good.
You know? And I think, so, yeah, I think that in a way that can speak to the genuineness of this particular leader, Zelensky. I've never seen him spin anything. I've never seen him rehearse or that there's a show of rehearsal. He, you know, in person talking to him, there's no, you know, I understand that somebody's trying to sell something, whether it's a policy or a pineapple, you know, they have, you spend enough time with them, you're going to run into their script.
Yeah.
He's learning more every day. There's no, that was an old script.
Yeah. Yeah.
Incredibly fast study.
I think there's a difference between the world at war and a world war, where there are sides and there's and things are drawn out, and maybe one begets the other.
Look at two of the things that I'll never have the answer to in total. One, so there's that dynamic of those patriots, and I'll circle back to the point, that are determined and have the opportunity out of their hard work, their courage in some cases, sense of service. I will be more potent working from the inside and not worrying all the bureaucratic and political bullshit that I have to deal with. Call that Colin Powell, right? Where there's a certain, in my view, like a certain tragedy to what happened.
For sure.
But I believe that that guy,
that's who he is,
took that bullet for this country. Now, he lied. He was a puppet in it. But that, you could see how that can happen in that bubble where if I step out, it's going to be worse, right? I can't resolve that. I can't say, hey, that guy's a sellout. I can't do it. I can't, because, you know, the rest of us, you know, can, you know, si se puede, but we can, you know, it's like, you got, so when we're in these conversations about discussing, you know, compassion for Palestinians, first thing I would say is, well, what are you doing for anybody right now? Yeah. And most people are not really being very exciting in their fulfillment of their responsibilities as humans on Earth today, and as Americans, and people who for the moment are, with all the emotional division and war that's going on, and war of words, and the assault on basic imagination or language, we still are breathing here. Imagine Iran says, well, let's take all of our resources and find a great incentive, including cash and weapons, for the cartels of Mexico to invade the United States. Well, then that would be very much like what the Israelis are going through right now. And would my first focus be on compassion for other innocents outside my home? Probably not, though I have always had what I believe it will become, again, the reasoned, necessary conversation about the incredible mistreatment of the Palestinians. Their bad guys have done their innocence and are doing now so much harm. And yet both sides are being punished by the inactivity of good people all around the world and in the United States as well. And the lack of curiosity to understand any of the dynamics like this. And so we're all in this.
Yeah. A lack of curiosity, but an absolute just freedom to just espouse thoughts and make statements and sing from the mountaintops, waving your flag, saying it's this way or the next.
Yeah, and to talk from a place of such relative safety, most of us.
Right.
Yeah, we know that we have communities that are generations of you know, war. We have communities where children have grown up in some version of war. So many guns on our streets, you know, kids killing each other, drugs and bullshit. But I'm not very interested in the self-righteous. We can't talk about this. We can't, you know, if somebody's talking about something they're invested in, if there's somebody who actually takes the time to understand the dynamics of poverty among the Palestinians, of conflict, of lack of, you know, sovereign territory. and they want to talk about that, I'm all for it. I would hope that they would speak about it in a way that respected the sensitivities and the humanity of these people who've lost family members, right, and so on.
That's right.
And vice versa, of course, mm-hmm, because now we're talking about the Israelis and the Palestinians, and guess who we're not? Either of them.
That's right. And the one thing that I think that that at least we're trying to do here, man, is the one thing that I find that's pretty much uniform in anybody who's actually walked the walk, not just talk about it, is they come at it with a real empathy and respect to not run their mouth, and that they understand that they've been in a situation that they've looked the so-called fucking enemy in the eye and said, you know what? Like, there's things about these people, there's things about these folks that I see in myself, there's things that I respect about them, there's things that I see on my own side that are fucking bullshit. And you can only really come to that point when you actually walked in that valley. You can't do it just fucking cheerleading from the side. You just can't.
Yeah, there's a combat veteran named Jake Harriman who has started a group called More Perfect Union. He's got a TED Talk where he is exactly the situation you're talking about at the Battle of Nazaria. So his unit, it could be said that they're a forward military enforcement of counterterrorism. And he came eye to eye with what that is and talks about extreme poverty in really clear terms. And it's one of those things sort of, again, like, it's not beautiful, you know, where to hear it from a clearly compassionate person, but who's facing it in a, I could get killed over this right now. Yeah. My life, yeah, my memories of mom, yeah, my,
that's right,
everything's gone.
Yeah.
And with courage, it's a good time to talk to people who have been eye to eye with this stuff. And I'm not talking about me with my old camera making a documentary. I'm talking about the people who are living there in it, the soldiers who are in it. The rest of it, we should try to be as tolerant as we can be and try to see if the people talking about what they're talking about are serious people, or if they're just jacking off, which I think there's just a lot of coming in the streets right now.
A whole lot of that, yeah. When were you first aware of your own curiosity? And I'm really interested in sort of the role it played in you as a performer, as an artist, and how it's sort of transcended, how it's different.
I think it's fair to say that, you know, my father, who he and his crew during World War II, they had a 7-mission life expectancy. They were doing low altitude bombings over Germany, shot down twice, both times got the aircraft over Allied lines before they jumped. And after 7 missions, it was voluntary. And they did 37 missions.
Wow.
And so this is a, you know, this is something growing up with Dad. Like, and the great generation, don't talk about it. No, he would have. I didn't ask enough. But, and then getting blacklisted by the country he just risked his life for.
Yeah.
And never being bitter about it. You know, he loved this country and you know, immigrant parents and grew up during the Depression, and he just felt that the blacklist was growing pains of a great nation. Hmm. Never bitter. Hmm. I thought, man, I'd like to be that guy. That won't happen. But it's, again, a nice aspiration. So he must have influenced some desire to have purpose in this way, at least. You know, fortunately, we had to register for the draft when I was 17. But we were well out of range of it happening, of the war was dwindling down in Vietnam. I remember Emilio Estevez, you know, took the position because he was in my high school and we were friendly. He was a year younger than me, I think, but he burned his registration card. I thought, well, you know, I'll give him the registration card. I can decide about what, you know, if I'm a Quaker or not later.
Yeah.
And so that skipped us. There was no mandatory service, which I think is a shame. And by that, I don't mean military service. I mean, you have to pick. You know, if you're not going to go to a school after high school, then you got to do 2 years of service. Because I think once a young person has that experience of helping someone, they know they matter. And it never goes.
Fuck yeah.
We got a whole generation of people who don't think they matter. Their vote doesn't matter. Nothing they do matters. The next thing you know, they're jumping around the Capitol like monster idiots, doing everything that destroys the notion of patriotism or community or care.
Thinking they're doing something that matters.
And some of that is, you know, it is true that many of them actually were in the service in some way, but mostly people who have been in service, whether it's military or the Peace Corps or whatever, if they do that formative time of their life, they really have had an experience of mattering. And finding that in our generation, there was no formalized thing. There was, you know, you're at the end of the war and your mission, your purpose, your service could have been to oppose the war. But then I was watching and seeing the people who opposed the war, you know, the hippies that I was fascinated with, and, you know, an anti-Vietnam family. And I adopted that feeling, I agree with it still, that we shouldn't have been there. But when your heroes of the anti-war movement are now calling all these soldiers baby killers when they get back because they're, you know, that to go to war, if a military doesn't follow these orders, you know, there are unambiguous times, but I can't say that that wouldn't have been difficult to see that they were doing the wrong thing until later. And that wasn't their wrong thing. It's a policy thing. It's the same heroism that's in World War II.
For sure.
And without people willing to go and to follow a chain of command, we would not be in this comfort zone that we're still to a degree in.
That's right.
So tracking back to what happened, the peel of the onion that I found is, of course, I would go with this question. I'd say my dad had this impact on it. And then, you know, 9/11 had an impact on it. But memory plays its own games with us, it was very recently that I went back to, I know exactly what happened. It happened when I decided to be an actor.
Yeah.
Because I decided to be an actor to play the story of Phil Oakes, which I never did for various reasons. But my younger brother, 5 years younger, Christopher, he started, even though we came from, my mother and father were actors, and my dad was a director for years in television, mostly television. And that had no conscious impact on me wanting to be in it. I never thought that I would be in what they had done. I wanted to be F. Lee Bailey. I was reading all his books in high school and wanted to be a criminal lawyer. Until I graduated and realized that I didn't pay attention at school at all, and I'd have to go to junior college to make up credits to get into a decent school. So I wasn't going to be a lawyer. But I had by then started in the senior year doing what my younger brother taught me to do, which is make films with Super 8, you know, the magnetic strip sound. Can't you get this film with the sound right on it? And you go make these little crime dramas and things like that. And so I still wasn't thinking I'm going to be an actor, but I was having to act in them because other people did their homework and we were shooting all night and instead before school. And because you get the Ektachrome film and you could shoot like in Westwood where the storefront lights were glowing enough, you could get exposure and shoot, you know, street crime shows. And so my younger brother was starting, because he was fascinated with the Vietnam War, and he would get, at 12, he'd get on the RTD bus and he'd look at a guy, and if that guy was of age and riding rapid transit, it was a pretty good bet he had fought in Vietnam. Mm. And Christopher would bring these guys home. And he'd be sitting around with a bunch of older veterans when he was 12, 13, 14, making these Vietnam movies with his friends and informed by these guys. And one
he'd be shooting the movies and he would have those guys.
Yeah.
Fucking A, man. Yeah. Fucking A.
There's actually a movie that depicts this. Art Linson made a movie called Wildlife that Christopher's in. But there's a relationship between this kid, not played by Christopher, that they based on Christopher and his friends and this thing. And Randy Quaid plays the veteran. Wow. So why am I spinning all of this around? My long way of saying is that I started to hear a song that he was using to score one of the scenes. And it was a topical song. And it really was, I thought, who the fuck is that? And I don't know what it was that got me, but then I started reading about Phil Oakes. And the guy who, you know, had a gig at Madison Square Garden that was going to put his record over the top, but on his way to the Garden got a call that the miners in Virginia need you, man. You got to get down and play this rally for them. And next thing you know, there's people standing at Madison Square Gardens and where's Phil? And he ain't going to make it, man. He's down in Virginia playing for the miners, you know, and it was just kind of like this. I don't know what it was, but I just got so fascinated with him. And then this was 77, 78. And by the time I got the book about him and found that a year earlier, at the age of 36, he'd taken his own life. And it was, I thought, nah, I could have found that guy. I needed to know that guy. And the things he could have written about the world going on now. And, I mean, just such a touched person. And I feel like he, you know, it's a speculation, but I've come to know his family very well and his daughter. And with the end of the Vietnam War, which he had fought with everything in him. And he was a guy that wore a suit and tie and short hair. Yeah. He thought, you know, if America has a choice between Richard Nixon and the hippies, they're going to take Richard Nixon, right? And I'm not going to be that, you know? He has this one song, and I'll get back to the point. I cried when they shot Medgar Evers, tears ran down my spine. I cried when they shot Mr. Kennedy as though I'd lost a brother of mine. But Malcolm X got what was coming. He got what he asked for this time. So love me, love me, love me. I'm a liberal.
Wow.
But he, so even today, I can't, you know, what is that? Why is that what moved me, that guy? And he was my mandatory service. There was something that I had to follow in that guy. And which I guess led me, in, down to the answer to whatever the answer is to that question or those kind of questions. It's like that one turning point. You know, people talk about it, that one teacher you had, I'm doing these things. For better or worse, and I've done both, better and worse, but I'm doing them largely out of, I don't know if you call it inspired by, but touched by the power that I felt through Phil Oakes.
When did you start to see that your access could satiate your curiosity, and what is it that's driving you? I mean, I know for, there's a bunch of us, I know for me that kind of go into every time that I get the opportunity to play a role, you know, that there's, I don't know whether it's a shame, but I go into each time thinking, shit, here I am. I get this unbelievable opportunity and these people are opening up their lives to me and they're welcoming me in and they're letting me know, they're letting me walk in their shoes a little bit. And then at the end of the day, I put some makeup on and say some lines. Mm. And for some reason, then I get celebrated that I can walk in any walk. But those are the guys that are really doing it. And there's this yearning the entire time to just try to touch on a reality that they have. And for me, the only way I could really explain that is there's always just it's humility, and that's sometimes a bit of shame. And I'm just wondering how, with research or however it was, you know, when you first started to find access into digging into parts, how that kind of plays into now, or whether there's a congruous sort of road there. Does that make any sense?
Oh yeah. Yeah, look, I think most actors that are, you know, worth their salt, let's say, will also tear themselves apart with this stuff. You know, you feel so much responsibility. And part of what I think you're talking about, and I'm pretty sure I know exactly what you're talking about, is, you know, am I a fraud? Is what we got to get past. It's one of the things we got to get past when we go there. And I think the biggest, and God, On, except for movies that I really don't like, you know, for whatever reasons, things that I've done that I just think, oh, you know, I think I'm awful at it or something else. If I take the movies that I'm proud to have been a part of and reasonably proud of, or maybe more than that sometimes, what I was able to bring to the party of a good movie, I'd want a do-over in all of them. And the only adjustment I'd make is to not go be close to the experience of when we have to do that chaos, and to just say, you know, don't get in the way of representing them by demanding to represent them. The grocery clerk you're playing, the police officer, anybody, right? Just anytime that I have been proud, it's when I stayed out of the audience's way. I've kept my struggle with myself out of the audience's way. There should be room. And I think that to varying degrees, working to just be free of all of that is, as an actor, is when you feel it singing, you know, when you really, and not only because you're singing, but because you're really hearing this person and they're feeling hurt, so they're singing in the scene. And we have those, when we stumble on those things, they're pretty instructive. So for example, me, here's a struggle I always had. Philosophically, I haven't resolved it, so I'll leave it to your listeners to decide, but if they're interested. I was a terrible auditioner, really terrible. And I was a terrible auditioner, well, I would say for the same reason I wanted to do this interview here. So I'm home, and I always talked a lot at home. I've had people close to my life living in under my roofs who had business cards made that they would just hand me after a couple of hours in a social gathering. And it only said, stop talking. But until I was 5 years old, I never talked outside of my house. And I didn't want to do something that I wasn't going to do well. And so I was waiting until I felt like I had something to say. Many would argue that, you know, that I should not have said anything ever, but you should say that really shy kid. Yeah, they called me Gary Cooper when I was in kindergarten and all of that. But I was not, I liked being in that. It was not at all a lonely thing. But it might have not been a very generous thing either, that I wasn't engaging with other people in that way. And I never was comfortable really with it until I found alcohol. I'm not a non-drinker. I'm still not comfortable in most social circumstances. Now, if I'm with people, you know, I like, and in a comfortable situation, I can have a great time. But generally speaking, yeah, the bigger the crowd, the more lonely I am. So going into an audition, person of that personality background, that felt really silly. You know, that's pretend. Now I'm making pretend for these people. And I was terrible at it. I loathed having to do it. But man, if I was legitimized by a paycheck and the word action on a set, I could drop all of my inhibitions and feel almost like, well, the tangibility of an assassin. You just get in the zone and go, and then kind of come out of it and you say, wow, that's interesting. And you do it again. So you have me thinking about, you know, when it comes to honoring people that we play,
yeah.
You know, we already are them, right? Everybody kind of around it. And it, I think of, for example, the greatest test ever for any actor, and it should be mandatory in acting school, is I want to hear you as an air traffic controller. You know, there's that thing. It's generally the same rhythm, the same cadence. It's as if it's the same person, and the bounce back and forth, even the humor when it's exchanged in those interactions between pilots and air traffic control. That's going to tell you, want to know if somebody can be real? Have them read a scene as an air traffic controller and a pilot.
Remember when you could fucking listen on planes, man?
Yeah.
When you could just listen to that the whole way. I listened to it the whole fuck. I used to be scared shitless of flying, man. I listened to that the whole fucking way. That's fucking great. But you know, man, like when I just with the access thing, you know, the first film I ever did was World Trade Center, right? Oliver Stone. And you know, man, I had no idea. I didn't grow up around any actors. I had no idea about like research and that, you know, research to me was books, man. I had no idea that Oliver was going to take us down to the bus terminal and that we were going to meet these Port Authority cops and that we could go out with him every day for a month, that he was going to facilitate that. I had no idea that that was even a thing. And I got to know these guys. I played this guy named Chris Amoroso, who died in the when the towers went down. He left the youngest widow and his daughter, his wife Sophia and his daughter Jamie, and I met these two guys, Sergeant Finney and Officer Fairbanks, who were his two best friends, right? And I couldn't believe the level of trust that these guys put in me, and when we were doing that film, I had written a letter to Chris's widow, just asking for her blessing that I was going to be doing this, and just to say, look, his memory belongs to you. But if you want to be a part of memorializing this, you want to talk to me about Chris, I would love that. And I'm just some shitbag actor from Hollywood, and this this is sacred to you. And you know, the studio shut it down. The producer said you can't reach out. And in the film, they had ended up taking all of the wives and the children's names out of the movie, and they had completely taken that part out because the wives had gotten together and said they didn't want to be a part of it, and that had it had bothered me so much that I couldn't reach out to her. Mm. And then on my last day of that month of going around with Finney and Fairbanks, they say, "Hey, we got a surprise for you, kid," and they put me in a car and they took me out to her house. And I got to meet her, and now we've kept in touch, and we've become. And you use the word access. I couldn't fucking. I mean, to me, at that point, cops were guys that beat me up. Cops were guys like I didn't, you know. But I had the power to change your entire fucking idea of people, and the power of going into their lives and being able to walk among them and walk with them, and for me, that's always been my armor. That's always been, if I can do that, then I can walk in there and I can do anything. If I can walk among them, if I can call them friends and share space with them.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering, I guess that I felt that now, and I see it now that, you know, on a small scale, people know who the fuck I am and what that does and what that allows me to have the kind of conversations I have and how much richer my life has gotten, how much better of a dad I've become, better friend, better husband, better. I'm so unbelievable, more so than, you know, my dream of being able to, you know, raise my kids because I get to do the thing I love more than anything else in the world. This access is incredible. And I guess there's a commitment to researching these roles and to for a means for the end. And I'm just wondering, at a certain point, did this lead to what you're doing now? Was it, are they the same?
Probably the same hunger and probably the same satisfaction and curiosity. But also I think because, look, you and I have probably benefited a great deal from caring about what we do, and therefore including whatever I can eat to do it well, right? And we also know that in the mechanics of filmmaking, so for example, Bradley Cooper has a moment in American Sniper where he's taking his sniper rifle down or packing it away. And in just that moment, he's handling that weapon in a way that licenses everything else that sells. Just that moment, right? We know a lot of times we'll go out and do the research on everything. And sometimes it gets in our way on the movie. And you're sitting there and you're telling the director, that's not how they do it. And yet this little poetic license is going to make the scene that works work or not. And you got to tell a whole lifetime in 2 hours and there's going to be shorthands. And so sometimes the you know, that hunger for the reality and to represent it, to honor it, you know, we can lose track. And sometimes it's about, and this is just a learning curve for me, where you try to get selective about the things. At the same time, the thing that's most important, more than everything's got to be just like the real thing, which generally speaking does get in the way, there's the confidence that comes with having put in the time and to be able to offer options based on observations that you just had by being so focused on it. And I saw this, what had to be extemporaneous, closing argument of a debate. And it had to be extemporaneous because there was no way that this person could have known where the debate was going to go. And it was a debate on political correctness with sort of odd bedfellows, as it were, partnering on one side of the debate about political correctness. And that was the partnering of Stephen Fry with Jordan Peterson. Uh-huh. And on the other side, it was Michael Eric Dyson and Michelle Goldberg of the New York Times. And at the end of it, Stephen Fry, and God, I recommend this to everybody to see. Just look up Stephen Fry, closing argument. He summarizes, and it's an indirect way of addressing what we're talking about, but I don't want to give away too much, but he talks about that there's a kind of obligation to a certain, people will find it ironic that I'm saying this, lightness. And he's celebrating uncertainty, admitting that he's opposed to anything, any orthodoxy. And as it relates to acting, the orthodoxies, especially as young actors, can get us into trouble. And I think I recognized that pretty early on. So that, for example, I'll tell you two quick funny stories. Well, three chapters. One was the first movie I did, was Taps at a military academy. I'm going to tell you, they sent us through that training and we were taking it so seriously. I must have been 21 years old, 22, whatever I was. My last scene in that movie, I play the best friend of the leading actor, Tim Hutton. And then we've got this one crazy guy who Tom Cruise played, who's starting a riot, and it's a war with the National Guard. And I'm kind of the conscience for Tim, trying to tell him not to get in trouble with this thing. And so all these cadets have taken over the military school. They've gotten into the armory and he's got like an M60 and Tom Cruise does in the window, looking down at the National Guard. He's just wants a war. And Tim Hutton in that dramatic last scene sees him as Tom Cruise looks up at us and says, "It's beautiful, man, beautiful." And he starts the gun. Tim does the kind of classic no moment, you know, and runs and jumps. And I see my best friend, Tim, going for the Tom Cruise character, and I just want to get him. And so here's what happens. I get to set. Now the wall is all squibbed. It's all, you know, they took 5 hours of the previous day to pre-rig it with all these automatic weapon fire, and so we're going to walk it through once before. Let's make sure the guys, and Tim goes racing in, and they say, bap, 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 bap. You know, they're not setting them off yet.
Right.
And I hit the deck, and I start scrambling to get to Tim and grab his body, pull it, because he's been shot. And I'm supposed to grab him, pull him out. And I'm dragging. And Sean, you just went right out of the shot. Harold Becker, who is still a great friend today. And he said, just, you know, they basically wanted me to run through the hail of gunfire. And I argued like I had been in the business my whole life. And it was the producers were brought down. They this was not going to happen. I'm not going to do this. And I had never heard this thing before, which is, look, do one this way, and then we will re-rig the wall, you know, and we'll do, you know, and we did. Well, I go to the Avco Cinema, and when the movie comes out, and I'm sitting in the back row, and I'm watching the movie, and I've never seen a movie I was in before. And just at the moment that I am going to Tim, the guy, having no idea that the actor playing this role in front of him was sitting behind him, this guy says, "Hit the deck, asshole!" And that set me up for not listening to directors for a long time. And sometimes still, but on this kind of, you know, this devotion to the craft, if there were a movie about actors researching,
yeah,
there's been a comedy about it.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not as funny as mine.
Yeah.
So here's what happened. So I told you, months out with LASO and with LAPD.
Yeah.
And so sheriff's office, I suspect, to a degree still, it was known as kind of being more no-nonsense. They didn't have a civilian police commission. Yeah. The sheriff usually stood behind his guys, and they would, some might use the term violate civil rights more often. But they were definitely an effective intelligence gathering group. They were taking on some of the tougher areas of the city. And I think, to be fair, it worked pretty tough. But it was in, at that time, remember, we're talking about the early 80s. It wasn't like today. I mean, it was, once, you know, I was out two nights with these guys and things would get hairy sometimes. They did not have a problem letting me hide a weapon under here in case something happened to them. And, you know, the actor, you today try that. But they were, I wouldn't have done it without them being aware of it. And so, okay. So it was every other night with one department or the other. There's a sergeant. I'm assuming he's retired now and wouldn't mind me telling the story, but I promise that this can be researched, not on Google, but these people are around because there's too many of them not to, too many witnesses. So this is the opening scene of the movie about the actor prepares.
Yeah.
So I've spent all this time, and I'm, you know, it's interesting, and this guy would let me ride around just with him, and we'd do warrants.
Yeah.
You know, he'd say, "Well, you got a warrant on this guy. You want to do this?" So one day we're rolling around, and I was wearing the windbreaker, and I had a 4-inch 38 caliber that I would keep underneath it here. And we see these guys standing out in front of a van, in front of a little house down in the South Central Los Angeles area. And I won't say which color, but they're wearing either red or blue.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, "Well, you say we jack them up." The sheriff's office, tactically, they would, I don't know if they still do, but they would either you were over the car or down on your knees, fingers interlaced, and he would be behind, and he had them all like that. My job was to secure the van that would, so there's the house, the van, the guys. So he's one police officer, one sheriff's deputy, and an actor. And So I've got my flashlight again like this, and I go per training to the blind spot, which is between the back panel windows and the side panel windows. And I've got the light, and I know probably the drugs, you've been told, they're going to be up inside the door handle, or they're going to be here. And like the night before, I'd also be close. You see a gun, you say gun, right? And I come and I'm going to do what you'll know what this is, but a quick peek, right? So nobody's reflexes are fast enough. If the wall's here, I can get around here and see what's going on before you're going to be able to pull a trigger or something. Well, I pick the night because I go like this and I go from the blind spot. I do the quick peek and a gun is pointing right in my face. I say, gun. Now he has about five guys. And they're all prone out facing the street. Oh, not prone out. They're on their knees. He can't get out of the line of fire of that van.
Yeah.
I'm now back in cover. He's on his radio and he's, you know, calling the cavalry. And all of these guys, the cavalry who will come, they knew me because some of them had been training me.
Yeah.
And he kicks each of the guys who's on their knees. He kicks them down on the ground because he doesn't want any of, he hasn't even gotten to search them all yet. And so they're all on the ground. They're complaining somewhat, but they're on the ground. His gun is on them. And suddenly a lot of police cars are showing up. And I'm seeing faces that I know. And they're giving me hand signals. They want me to, what I read is, now some time has passed. They want me to do one more quick peek because that person could have moved, just to identify where, which part of the van, because they got me, they don't want hurt.
Yeah.
They got him in the line of fire. So I might now just peek it. And again, this is the 1980s. And reconfirm position and get under the van and stay there because they got shit to do.
Yeah.
And now it's daylight because now there's a helicopter over this whole scene.
Right.
And I'm like, okay. And I check. And the gun, of course, was still pointing at me because it was my reflection.
Oh, shit.
And all of this chaos was because I saw a gun.
Oh, shit.
That was, yeah.
Oh, my God.
So you think I got ragged for a little while on that?
Oh, shit. That's the fucking greatest.
Yeah. For years, sometimes I'd run into some guy with a mustache. He'd say, you know, I was a young cop at that time. I was there that night. Yeah. You know, it's going to destroy. I'm never going to let an actor go on a ride along again now that I've given this interview.
So fucking good.
Oh, that's so good. The most humiliating moment anybody could ever have.
Wow, dude. Holy shit.
It's all about how you get back up, John.
Yeah, there you go, brother. There you go. Yeah, you have time for a couple more, no?
Sure.
What do you think about movies today? Like, where do you think we're at now? What's better about show business now? What's worse? What's the state? Are there truth tellers now? Are there artists right now that you really admire? What do you think about it? Because I just don't know that we, for me, at least from where I sit, and I think of you and the things that you've done and of this like generation of the greats and my heroes. And I don't really know who else is out there. I'm tremendously worried about it. And mm-hmm. I'm worried about the attention span of the audience. I'm worried about what people, the shit that's being made, the shit that I'm reading. I'd just like to know what your thoughts were.
Well, okay, let's start with the good stuff.
Okay.
Right? So, you know, we're sitting here most certainly, you know, not without Shia LaBeouf and my having stumbled on that great conversation the two of you had, you know, the vodka tonic at night and turning on the television. And I just saw, have you seen the play that he's doing?
I did.
Well, so I think that that's a zone that would have been extraordinary at any time in cinema or theater. Mm-hmm. So there are people operating at a really high level. When I mentioned the Stephen Fry thing, you know, part of talks about young people being very anxious because they don't know how to operate, how to navigate what they can say, what they can't say. He talks about diversity and that those who are pushing diversity are pushing it in a very undiverse way. You can't be diverse in your language, your behavior. It's a kind of, you know, I don't want to be necessarily officially associated with a lot of people who maybe in this topic I agree about a lot of it, but I think we're doing ourselves an incredible disservice by thinking in that way, which will make us popular amongst the loudest. It's less colorful and it's less challenging. And when things are limited in, you know, through the kind of, what would you call it, peer pressure and careers at risk, when people can be pigeonholed as less than, as easily as today, it's going to affect the movies. It's going to create an invisible sense of self-censorship. It's going to decrease the magic. And so we're giving the magic to machines. You and I could go to anywhere in any group today, and if we sort of benignly bring up Lenny Bruce, everyone at the table is going to say, oh, God, he was a genius. He was a genius. Because that's what they know makes them kind of hip to that generation, right? Then you start running through some of his routines for them.
Right.
You're comfortable now.
Right.
Because he was a genius.
Right.
And he was funny. And good luck trying that now. Again, it goes back to if we're going to take ourselves so seriously, if we're so dangerous to ourselves and others because we have an odd thought that maybe it takes a little bit of a thick skin from one group of people. Maybe I'm in that group, you know, get over it. It's funny.
Yeah.
You know, if it's funny, it's funny.
Yeah.
But yeah, so cinema is devastatingly affected by that.
Yeah.
And again, we are, it's kind of like George Orwell, we were all afraid of Big Brother, and then we thought that Big Brother was other, but now we are Big Brother. We're doing it to each other.
That's crazy.
Get on that little cell phone and do the, so I'm not happy with the state of that. There's still magic being made. There's still some people who defy this stuff, you know. I don't think that I would be functional without a little Bill Burr here and there. Just obviously I'm not going to be able to trying to represent everybody in this, but it extends to any group, that within every group we have to find the balance that celebrates the individual, that the individual isn't always having to represent their group. They get to be a person too. So like the Philip Roth Human Stain book. Mm-hmm. I just saw this documentary that Elvis Mitchell made on the history of black cinema. And there's some scenes, because my father made two movies in his life, feature films. And the first one was 1965, A Man Called Adam. And it was a black film. White director, in that case. And it's covered briefly in Elvis's documentary. But so this should not be on the quota or the cultural quota.
Yeah, to make some executive quota feel like he's doing the right thing.
But this should be on recognizing how important it is to us, right? And so I think it's the wrong paradigm that we're moving to get it, right? It's the right thing, in theory.
Yeah.
But the paradigm should be like when we wake up and take responsibility, we will want and need that in the culture. Instead, the political correctness that is now embedded in so many people's, it's a, I just think it's a really dangerous. And we, what we'll do is we'll give up American cinema for cinema around the world that is just going to not be so bothered with it. You know, when I hear arguing about pronouns here, while, and I say it in the movie, while kids are being vaporized, lucky you get to argue about, you know, grammatically incorrect things. It's just silly. And I feel for people's, you know, solo journeys with things that, you know, gender identification, things like that. And I don't like the activist thing about it. And I think it's a bad thing for culture. I don't know. I don't know where it's going to go. Cinema, I just don't know. Like I said, there's still some great things coming around. You try to pick them.
Yeah.
Pick as an audience or as a practitioner.
What if you had to single one thing out? When the first thing that pops in your mind when I say what are you most proud of? What would that be?
In film or in my life? Well, there was a movie a long time ago called The Gumball Rally, and I think Raul Julia was playing the part. I saw it when I was a kid. It's his, you know, cross country race, and he's not Italian, but he's playing an Italian driver.
There.
God forbid anybody but a Danish prince play Hamlet.
Yeah.
And he's driving his car, and he's got teams in the cars. And first thing he does is he grabs the rearview mirror, pulls it off, and checks it out the back of the car's draft at 120 miles an hour. And he looks at the other guy and says, "First rule of Italian driving, what's behind you does not matter." You know, so I'm a little like that. And so I guess, you know, where I am today, what I'm most proud of is always my kids. And in my work, it's this movie, Superpower, is for me the best film I've been involved with, and can be, I think, a participant in moving the dial on this Republican Congress and where we go with the next period of time. I just really believe that not only principally, but politically, the win is overspend if we have to, enact defense production if we have to not diminish our stockpiles in a dangerous world, but we should be taking care of getting everything that Ukraine needs to them yesterday. And and if I'm a young person in America, and I remember all those Ukrainian flags flying outside, and our parents and our teachers and our leaders all committing to Ukraine with so much vigor, I would sure benefit from seeing them follow through, and the back and forth, and the kind of trickle in, trickle out, and it would just make me not believe in anything, and not believe that there was a generation of courage that preceded us, and not be inspired to carry it over into mine and to my kids. And I just think that if you want to increase mental health, tell them how much you love them, call that support the Ukrainians, and then don't give the love later, and you will have mental health problems. Wow. And so, yeah, so that's, I hope this film will just bring people's attention to it. They don't have to agree with my opinions that's stated within the film. The film is kind of crafted to also just let somebody who didn't have time to go over to Ukraine, they can, you know, get in my sidecar with me and see what they see.
Yeah. Thank you for doing this.
Thanks, man.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
I jabbered.